Tonight, this gentleman that's going to be speaking has become a friend, a mentor, and my sponsor. We started out, we came together going and serving in the jails. And after listening to him many, many weeks, I got up the courage and said, "Would you be my sponsor?" And the reason I picked Lewis to be my sponsor was because he had what I wanted. Plain and simple. He had the right attitude, the right words, and actions, more importantly. We both agree that we love going in and serving in the jails, but we love even more being able to go out, free men. So with that, and without any further ado, I give you my dear friend, Lewis S.
All right, Tim and I set this thing right here up, and I had to put a leg under it, so if it falls over, I mean, he was like, I just threw it under there, and it just stayed, so I'm sure it's not. But my name's Lewis, I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here tonight. You know, it's funny, when alcoholics get all the attention, all of a sudden now they don't want it. I love doing 12-step work. You know, this particular thing ain't my favorite thing to do, but like Kevin said, we go into jail and we carry the message, and man, I love it. You know, God took an old drunk like me that nobody didn't want to see coming and surely like to see leaving, and turn me in to give me a power that only we have, you know, that psychologists and psychiatrists, you know, you can pay them all this money and they can't do what we can do because we have that common bond of being alcoholics. And when you talk to each other, those guys in the jail know that we know you. You know, they know that we know that I'm not in there preaching. I'm not even in there teaching. I'm in there sharing my experience with them. And they know that we get it. But anyway, I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about what it was like. And it's probably not much different from a lot of y'all's, what happened and what it's like now. And we'll just dive right into it. I'm going to just say before I get started that I'm sure I'm going to say some things that y'all don't agree with. I'm going to say some things that might even make you mad. You know, we're pretty opinionated in here. I have my own opinions. But the thing I've noticed is that my opinions change, you know, and things I said 5 years ago, you know, I have a different, you know, so this is where I'm at in my journey right now, and it may be different, you know, but we're each in where we're at. So with that, I'm from South Georgia in the flatlands, I had a dysfunctional family coming up. My dad was an alcoholic. He worked for the railroad, and his problem, like most alcoholics, won't go to work. His problem was that he would go to work. He would not go if they called him in, and he would be on call, and they would call him, and he'd go in, and he'd show up drunk. But we were all living in Bowden, and I got three sisters and another brother, and I'm the baby of the bunch. And out of five of us brothers and sisters, three of us are alcoholics. And my mom and dad both were alcoholics, so that's pretty high numbers. I was an alcoholic when I took my first drink. And you can argue all day that you can't be born an alcoholic, and I'll argue you can, because I am. Because I was the only one doing the math on it. And only an alcoholic knows what doing the math is. It's when four of you buy a case of beer. That's six apiece, baby. So if I can get through my six, then that's right. And that's the way I drank from the beginning. There was never enough. Chuck C. said that he could sit at his window and look out at Laguna, you know, at the ocean, and see all that ocean water, and if all of it turned into liquor, it still wouldn't be enough. And that was the story of my life, that there was never enough. Ooh, that thing is loud. And so we were living in Bowden. He was drinking bad. him and my mom would fight the whole alcoholic thing, and still to this day, when I'm in an AA meeting and somebody drunk comes in, I still get really, really nervous, and I think it's from my childhood, you know, because I grew up a drunk. You think that I, but it still, it makes me extremely nervous. And I remember the earliest memories I have of Daddy. He was doing stuff with me. I mean, he was taking me and my brother fishing, and he was taking me. You know, he was doing stuff with me, but he was always drunk. You know, he was always drinking. But still, you know, I mean, I got sons too, and I know that he took me, you know, like fishing when I was 3 years old. And if you've ever taken a three-year-old fishing, that's not very fun. As a matter of fact, it's much more work than it is fun. So I know that he loved me and cared about me, but he done the best he could. He's like all of us. He done the best he could. But he was coming home one night and ran off a bridge drunk, and he died. So I remember packing up and leaving, and we moved to Scriven, Georgia. And I was living, all of us were living together, and my mom started drinking. And I mean, in school I did okay. You know, I don't really remember a whole lot. We were real close. I had a lot of cousins that lived down there, and I hung out with my cousins, like my friends. My sons can't imagine how I could be friends with my cousins, and we'd go to, we'd spend the night with each other, and so. But from there, we moved to Jessup, and that's when I really started. Like, I was like 11 or 12, and you know, I was a you know, adolescent, young adolescent. I was going through. My mom was drinking bad then, and there were guys in and out, and there was fights. She'd come home kicking the doors in, wanting the keys and wanting to drive, and we would all have to get in the car and leave, and along that time too, I was being molested by my brother, and I really didn't feel like that was the, like, I felt trapped, you know. There was nobody I could talk to, you know, and mom was doing her thing, and so my brother brought home this Ozzy Osbourne album, Blizzard of Oz, and that was my first drug of choice. I put that record on, man, and I'd play it and I'd listen to it, you know, I mean, for hours and hours and hours, and music was my first escape. You know, I could get in there and that music would fight for me, and it would hate for me, and it would cuss for me, and it would do all the things that I felt like I couldn't do, you know. And so I got into music heavy, to say the least, but along that time, you know, I started smoking cigarettes, just rebelling. You know, we didn't have, you know, we didn't go to church or anything, and I was just looking for something to give me some relief. I wanted some relief, and I didn't like the way I felt, and I didn't like what I saw when I looked in the mirror, and I was always comparing myself to everybody. You know, my insides to their outsides, and I didn't like the comparison. Come up way short. I felt I always felt different. I felt like I was on the outside of life looking in, and I've heard a lot of alcoholics say that, you know. So, but I felt different, and I wanted something to change the way I feel. And not long after that, I took my first drink with my cousin. We were out camping out one night, and his mom had liquor inside, and I had my first drink, I loved it, no doubt. It was an instant love affair. It was, I mean, I couldn't imagine how I'd gone this long without this stuff, man. It just, it was, my God, it did everything for me that I couldn't do for myself, you know. I thought it made me cool. I thought, it, you know, I could talk to women. I was very shy, you know, and all of a sudden I could talk to women, and I thought I was tough. I probably wasn't, but I thought I was. But it done all this stuff for me. And the first night, you know, I got drunk and I fell over something. I hit my chin, and I just, all this crap happened. But and when I woke up the next morning, when I thought back over the night before, that ain't what I thought about. I didn't think about the bad stuff that happened. I only could remember the way it made me feel. And it was an instant love affair, and I stuck with it for as long as I could. And I give it hell, man. And like I said, I was an alcoholic when I took my first drink. You know, there wasn't no drinking over the line. And I knew I was an alcoholic early on. You know, I didn't have to come to AA to look at the first step and say, you know what, I think I may be an alcoholic. I knew I was an alcoholic. I just didn't think that. My problem wasn't step one, it was step two. You know, I knew I was an alcoholic, but I didn't think God could fix me. I didn't think He was that powerful. Or I didn't think He wanted to. You know, because you know what we do when we go through the drinking life. So I set off to do my drinking, and I got in all the trouble, and I started hanging around all the kids at school that were smoking cigarettes and you know, listening to Motley Crue and were rebelling, and you know, we were partying and thought we were cool. And I used to have this shirt that had the sleeves cut out, and it was a Motley Crue shirt, and on the back it had kicking ass on the wild side. And my mom used to work at this treatment center, and I remember this guy reading that on my shirt and kind of laughing. He was a counselor there, so he knew somebody. No, I thought I was cool, but he could see through it, and he was right, because it wasn't long I would get my ass kicked on the wild side for sure. You know, it didn't take long before the love affair turned on me. You know, yeah, alcohol gives you that illusion of, and it did. You know, give you that illusion of giving you something. But in the end, it only takes, and the big book calls it a rapacious creditor. And you know, once you cross that line, that's it. It's just take, and that's what it did. And I started getting in trouble, and I started getting felonies and DUIs and you know, all the stuff that we do. And I went to treatment several times, you know, but never for the right reasons. Always because I was running from the law, or because I wanted to get mom off my back, or because I wanted to, or I just wanted to quit hurting, or but never to stop drinking, because I didn't think I could stop drinking. I didn't think I had a choice. And I guess if you don't think you do, then you don't. I was willing to mix some things up, but I wasn't going to stop drinking. Like, I was on intensive probation one time. I don't think they have it anymore. They call it something else. But the police ride out to your house, and you know, they can come out any time. And the dude gave me this long list of things I couldn't do. And if we catch you drinking or smoking dope, you know, you're going to prison. And I told him I understood. And his brake lights weren't out of my sight good before I was popping the top on a beer. And my friends were like, you just want to go to prison. I was like, no, I don't. I don't want to go to prison, but I'm not going to stop drinking. I can't stop drinking, you know. I can't, you know, in the big book where it says, can't imagine life with or without alcohol, that's where I was at. I couldn't imagine going on, but I couldn't imagine not ever taking a drink again, you know. And what do people do that don't drink, you know? I was scared. It was fear. Fear. When he says 100 forms of fear, I think I had more than 100, probably a couple of 100 forms of it. I was scared of my own shadow, you know. Everything that I knew, I hid behind alcohol. If I messed something up, it was because I was drinking. If I wasn't good enough, it was because, you know, all my insecurities and everything was hid behind alcohol. So I started getting in trouble, and they got tired of hearing from Mama, and got tired of hearing her go up and get me out of trouble, and I started paying some consequences, and like I said, I got some felonies, and I got sent to boot camp one time and narrowly missed prison by that, and I'm grateful for that I never actually went to prison. I did, you know, some time in the county jail, but we had started going to church, and I had started, I knew that, I figured that the answer was God. I just didn't know where to find Him, so I started looking. And I went to this Christian treatment center, and I was like, surely God's here, because it's a treatment center for alcoholism, and it's for Christian, it's Bible-based, and it was in North Carolina, and I just got thrown out of it. I just, and got sent back home. And one time I was up there at the same one, and they used to put you in this little room, and you're supposed to listen to sermons. And I had a cassette tape of And of all the tapes I had, it was AC/DC Highway to Hell. And the guy, the director, flat busted me. So, you know, he threw me out. And I actually hitchhiked to Charlotte, North Carolina after he did that. You know, just floating, man. Not just no purpose in life, no direction. Just floating around. And God actually protected me from that because I got bad drunk and ended up in some places I didn't know anybody up there, and it was a miracle that something bad didn't happen to me. But God, you know, looks out for fools and drunks. And but I was at the end of it then. I was just drinking and just I didn't want to draw sober breath. That, you know, I was too scared to kill myself, so I was just going to drink myself to death. That was my plan. You know, that was the best plan I could come up with at the time. But actually, I thought it was a pretty good plan. I just was going to drink so much so fast that I wasn't going to wake up. And damn, I kept waking up, you know. I finally caught another charge and got sent to John's place in Statesboro. And it's a 30-day, you know, and I almost got through out of there for messing with women, you know. Trying to act like I was some kind of suave, Darren Arrow guy, you know, and really I was scared to death just hiding behind that facade, but I almost got thrown out, and that would have been the end. So they, instead of putting me out, they just let me leave a few days early, and they sent me to Kickstart, which is the first long-term residential treatment program I'd ever been in. And that guy was trying to send me up here to Gainesville, and I was like, no, I can't, you know. Especially when I heard it was a year-long program, I was like, I can't go up there for no year. You know, I got things to do. I don't know what I thought I had to do. But they weren't hearing it. They sent me up here anyway. And I mean, I'd like to say I come up here and then embellish this program and just fell in love with it from the beginning, but I didn't. I was fighting, you know. I really didn't want it to work. I really didn't want this to work. I really wanted this to fail so that I could go home and say, see, I tried it all. Nothing's going to work. The only thing left for me is to drink. And so I helped it along and tried to sabotage it. And I was a smart ass to all the people in the treatment center. And I broke all the rules. And I was argumentative. And I was a little punk, you know. And I was hoping they would just put me out. But they didn't, you know. I mean, I paid some. You know, they didn't let me buy scot-free, but I didn't get thrown out. And Dodie, she was the director at the time. She kept it enough interest. She kept me interested enough to where I finally got a sponsor and started working the steps. And it wasn't even the sponsor I wanted. Mr. J was Dodie's daddy, and he had been sober almost 40 years when I got there. And he told me who he thought I needed as a sponsor, and I didn't get it just because he told me. I was like, who's this guy? What does he know? You know, he's some old guy. He don't know what kind of sponsor I need, you know. And you know, I thought I knew it all. But I ended up getting that guy that he said, and he's still my sponsor to this day. But I started coming in, and I was still, even in a room full of alcoholics like y'all, I could see it, and I could make myself different from everybody in this room, you know. He's too old, she's too young, he's too black, too, you know. And by the time I got through, I could be different than all y'all, because if I could make myself different than all y'all, then I didn't have to follow y'all's rules, you know. I thought I was fundamentally different. I thought all y'all could get AA and y'all could get sober, but y'all wasn't me. Y'all didn't understand. I had these deep, you know, things that nobody else in the world ever had, and you know, this was, you know, these issues that, and but I come to find out I was just a garden variety drunk, just like everybody else, you know, nothing special about me. But I think when I mean I'd go in a room like this in an AA meeting, I'd just stare at the ground. I just didn't think that I didn't think that this would work. And but it come time to do my fourth step, and I did it, and I did it honestly. I did it very, very honestly, and I didn't leave anything out. And I think that as a result of that, I think that's the day that I actually joined AA. is after I'd done my fifth day with my sponsor, and he said that I was so lost with him that he told me things that he had done and that he had thought, and I knew that's the day that I felt a part of this program. I'd always been looking for something to be a part of all my life, and I found it. I found it here. And so for there, I just started doing what y'all told me to do. You know, I started. Larry told me not to ever say no to anything I was asked to do in AA, and I never have. I started working the steps, and I started going to meetings, and I went to a lot of meetings in the early days. I went to at least six a week, every week. Not out of a sense of obligation, but because I wanted to go. And I still like to go to meetings. I don't go to that many, but I still love to come to an AA meeting. And one of the main reasons why I like to come is to hear other people's problems. Because sometimes if I get away from this thing, I can turn into a victim, man. My wife didn't give me the respect that I, you know, my bosses, you know, and how dare he talk to me that way, and all these things, you know, that the ego, driven by the ego. And then when I walk through those doors, though, something happens, you know, and I remember, oh yeah, I remember what I am now. I'm an alcoholic, and it's not about me. You know, nowhere in that book does it say that God got me sober so that I could have all the things in my life that I never had before. Never. It ain't in there. Because I didn't get sober for me. I got sober for y'all. I got sober because God has a plan for me. And it works just the opposite of the way it does in the world. If I do God's work for Him, He takes care of me. I don't have to take care of myself anymore. I don't have to go out and get what I think I need anymore like I used to. I don't have to. That ain't my job. My job is to carry this message to the next alcoholic. That's what the big book says. It says we got sober to be of maximum service to other men. That's what it says. It don't say nothing about getting everything that I ever wanted. Although, while we're on the subject, I can tell you, I've gotten everything I've ever wanted. If I'd have wrote a list down of everything I wanted in sobriety, I'd have shorted myself. And I'm about to get teary-eyed talking about it up here now, but you know, that's mercy when God takes somebody like me who, you know, I didn't deserve it, man. I didn't do anything to deserve it, you know, and thank God that He don't give it to people that just deserve it. But He has mercy on us, and if we try to do the right thing, He will pour His blessings out on us. And He has a vested interest in helping us so that we'll go off and help other people and tell them how wonderful God is. And that's what I do. That's what me and Kevin do when we go to the jail. I don't tell them nothing that I ain't lived through. I just tell them how awesome God is. And you doubt Him if you want to, He'll make a believer out of you. I know, because I doubted Him. You know, I wanted Him to fail. I didn't want Him to be that big. I didn't want Him to be that powerful. And He was. So you can doubt Him if you want to. Matter of fact, He likes your kind. You know, He likes the kind that says you can't do it, because I did. I said He couldn't do it. Since I've been, you know, my story kind of sucks because I really didn't do anything big. I got here when I was 25. I never lost a career job. I never been married. I never owned a house. I never hell even owned a car. I owned a set of drums. And I actually got locked up and couldn't even finish paying on them. My mom had to finish paying them off. So I'm pretty sad, you know. I got here and so, I mean, I've had to really grow up here, man. And I've gotten married, you know, since I've been in here, and I've, you know, I got kids that so far have not seen me take a drink, and that's huge to me, you know, because I've seen my dad do that, and thank God they hadn't, and they're good kids, man, you know, they're good kids, and it's an honor to be a father and have, you know, people look up to me. Right? That's pretty good. And I got my part of the world. You know, I never wanted anything great out of any of it. I just wanted a piece of the world. I just wanted my little piece of the world. Just stick me over there and let me be like every damn body else. I don't want to be great, but I don't want to be terrible. I just want to be You know, I want why y'all want it. You know, I just want to be a part of life. You know, I was, you know, and that's what he gave me, and that's what I am. I'm a part of life, and I come home every day, and I try to do the right thing, and I screw this thing up sometimes. You know, I still, you know, have to watch the ego. I still get wrapped up in myself. You know, nowhere in the big book does it ever say I'm going to lose that or that one. You know, I'll always have to fight that some. But so I get off course a little bit, but overall the journey is going in the right direction, and I think that I think if I continue doing what I've done, I'll continue to get what I've been getting. And I think if I quit doing this, then I'll quit getting it. You know, Bill W. says that we have to keep giving it away. We have to keep working this program and giving it away in order to keep it, you know. And I think that's the main theme here is that giving it away. Bill W. knew there was something to one alcoholic talking to another when he didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. He hadn't written any of the steps. He was struggling to stay sober himself. But he knew one thing, that there was one power, some power that happened to him when he spent his time talking to another alcoholic. And he even went to Dr. Stillworth, I think it was Dr. Stillworth, and said, I've talked to all these drunks, and none of them stayed sober. And Dr. Stillworth said, yeah, Bill, but you stayed sober. You stayed sober. And that's it, you know. You know, we take this. The way I look at it, if I turn my life over to God, He takes all my bad stuff and turns it into good stuff. You know, when I was drinking, it was just more bad stuff and more bad stuff. But now it's actually, it makes me more. In the promises, it says, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. And so the further down the scale you go, the better off you qualify for AA. So you can't mess this thing up, you know. Or I haven't been able to, and trust me, I tried. But I don't know what time it is. Sometimes I spend a lot of time up here, and sometimes not a lot. But I'm not one to sit up here and ad lib and start talking about the step one and step two. And when I'm done, I'm done. But but I appreciate y'all asking me to come over here, and you know, I pray to God today that you know, I was worried about, you know, when I. You know, I heard a guy the other day talking about self-centered fear, and he was talking about, you know, in the Bible it says that perfect love casts out all fear. So used to, when I told my story, I get real nervous, man, because I'd be like, I wonder what they think about me. You know, I wonder what they think I look like. I wonder what they think about what I said. All that is self-centered fear. That's all it is. It's about a performance. You know, this ain't about a performance. This is about sharing. This is about helping one, maybe two people, maybe three, but helping somebody out there. But when you walk into this room and you look around, or when you get up here like I did today, and I looked around and I think of the people that I could possibly help. Like when we go to the jail, I don't ever walk into jail thinking, I wonder what they think I, you know, because I'm going with love and I'm going to help and I'm going to give myself, and then it don't matter. And then it don't matter. So, but anyway, thank y'all for listening, and that's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Lewis. You know, I feel pretty lucky. I get the chance to be in one or two meetings a week with this guy, and he shares just about every meeting, and everybody pays attention to what he says because he speaks from the heart. He's got the language of the heart down. Thank you, Lewis. Tinsley, you've been on the road. We need you to hand out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks for telling your story. That was great. I really enjoyed that. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life, we offer a white chip.
All right.
Anybody else for a white chip? For the silver chip for 30 days? How about 3 months? Red chip? Yellow chip for 6 months? Green chip for 9 months? Any birthdays tonight? Any AA birthdays? Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Big hand for the chips you hold.
Okay, thank you, Tinsley. Good job. Thank you all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Living high, a big piece of the pie. So many they got it wrong. As for me, when I wanted too much, ain't never enough. I know how it is to live and die. Always fearing that I'm gonna run out. Keep the good stuff to myself. Hide it from everyone else. Save it for a rainy day. If you wanna have it all the time, gotta give it. Sleep, it'll never leave if I give it and just.